Menards Black Friday sale is here. Get everything you need to bring home the holidays. A Nerf Blaster dog toy blasts tennis balls 75 feet. Fun for you and your pup. Just $15.99. Delicious Dubai chocolate is $12.99 a bag. Color-changing squish lamps and Performax drill bit sets are only $4.99 each. Menards has great Black Friday gifts for everyone in your family. Hurry in while supplies last. Good through November 30th. See Menards.com for details.
Here. Oh boy, got some blood going.
Yeah, this blood.
He's wearing it too.
Welcome to the bed. When you get over to the bed, we'll go ahead and give you the story. This is all going to happen super fast. Welcome to the emergency room.
70-year-old female, single driver of a vehicle. Appears that she went off-road into a ditch, rolled over her car onto a trailer, caved in the tunnel.
No,
the vehicle was caved in, and she was hanging out parked
in front of
the
window.
Welcome to the deep dive. Okay, if you are deep in MedSurg review, probably feeling that weight of just sheer volume of information for those big exams, you know exactly what we mean. It can be totally overwhelming.
It really can.
So we're here today to give you, well, maybe the ultimate shortcut. We're not reading a textbook here. We're applying that Pareto principle, you know, focusing on the vital 20% of material that really drives like 80% of good patient outcomes in acute care.
And our laser focus today, it's trauma shock management. This stuff is incredibly high yield clinically. Why? Because spotting and managing shock fast, I mean really fast, before organs start shutting down, that's literally the difference between life and death sometimes.
Exactly. So our mission for this deep dive is kind of twofold. First, we need to pull out the absolute clinical relevance. What do you really need to know to spot inadequate organ perfusion, poor tissue oxygenation?
Right. And second?
Second, prioritizing those immediate nursing implications. What's your next step? What action do you take right now? We're aiming to cut through all the noise and just give you that high signal info.
Let's start right at the foundation then, the definition. Shock isn't just low blood pressure, right?
Mm.
Fundamentally, it's an abnormality in the circulatory system. The result is inadequate perfusion of organs. And this is key, not enough oxygen getting to the tissues.
Okay. And that leads to a really critical point in trauma, doesn't it?
It does. No single vital sign, no single lab test can diagnose shock on its own. You absolutely have to synthesize everything, the clinical picture, the vitals, the labs, into one holistic high-speed assessment.
All right, let's unpack that then, starting from the ground up. To understand how it fails, we need to understand the system itself. Basic cardiac physiology, the pump mechanics. So the basic equation everyone learns, right? Cardiac output, CO, that's the blood pumped per minute. It's heart rate times stroke volume.
Simple enough on the surface.
Yeah, heart rate's easy to measure. But stroke volume, the amount of blood pushed out with each beat, that's where things get complicated in trauma, isn't it? It depends on three main things: preload, contractility, and afterload.
And in trauma, especially with hemorrhage, preload is often the first domino to fall. It's really the Achilles heel here. Preload is simply the volume of blood coming back to the heart through the veins.
How much the heart fills before it squeezes.
Exactly. Physiologically, it dictates the stretch on those heart muscle fibers right at the end of diastole, just before the next beat. So if you lose volume, preload takes an immediate hit.
And this brings us to the venous system. It's not just return pipes, is it? Our sources really highlight its importance.
Oh, absolutely not. You can't think of it as just plumbing. It's this massive adaptable storage tank, a capacitance reservoir. It holds almost 70% of the body's total blood volume. That's huge.
70%? Wow.
Yeah. And that volume isn't just sitting there passively. There's sort of a baseline volume that doesn't really contribute to pressure. And then there's the excess volume that does create what we call mean systemic venous pressure, or MSVP.
Okay, so MSVP. When a trauma patient starts bleeding heavily, what happens to that pressure?
Well, when you lose volume fast, you're basically draining that pressure-creating part of the venous reservoir. And that immediately lowers the pressure gradient, you know, the force that normally pushes blood back to the heart.
Like turning down the water supply to a pump?
Exactly like that. It's like draining the pressure from the intake hose of a fire engine. The pump itself, the heart, might be perfectly fine initially. But if the supply pressure drops too low, the pump just starves for volume.
And if the heart starves for volume, we run right into the Starling connection, that core link between volume and how well the heart pumps.
Correct. The Frank Starling mechanism. It basically says the force of the heart's contraction is directly related to how much its muscle fibers are stretched before it contracts.
Makes sense. More stretch, bigger snapback.
Precisely. And since venous return preload determines that stretch, less return means less stretch. And that means a weaker, less efficient contraction, even if the heart muscle itself, the contractility, is technically okay.
So in hypovolemic shock, the heart's struggling mainly because it doesn't have enough to pump, not because the muscle itself is failing initially.
That's the crucial distinction early on. The pump is being starved.
Okay, so volume drops, preload falls, the heart struggles. The body doesn't just sit there, though. It hits the panic button, right?
Mm-hmm.
What does that early compensation look like?
The body's first goal is survival maintained blood flow to the critical organs. The heart, the brain, the kidneys. And it does this through a massive sympathetic nervous system response, a flood of catecholamines causing intense vasoconstriction.
Squeezing the pipes.
Exactly. Blood gets shunted pretty fiercely away from areas deemed non-essential in that moment. So the skin, the muscles, the gut circulation, they get clamped down.
And that's why the patient's skin feels cool and clammy. That's the compensation happening.
That's it, precisely. That cool, pale, clammy skin is a sign of compensation in action. It's not just a symptom. It's physiology at work.
And what's the earliest sign we can actually measure that tells us this whole compensatory cascade is kicking off?
Tachycardia. Almost always. The heart senses that falling stroke volume, the starved pump situation, and it tries to keep the cardiac output stable by speeding up the rate. Heart rate goes up to compensate for stroke volume going down.
The desperate attempt to keep COSXSV balanced.
It's a frantic compensatory push. And the source is really clear on this. Tachycardia is typically your earliest measurable circulatory sign of shock, often way before the blood pressure actually starts to tank.
Okay, so we have this big circulatory shift shunting blood. But the real damage, the long-term stuff, happens down at the cellular level, right? That switch from aerobic to anaerobic metabolism. What's the clinical fallout from that?
Yeah, that cellular shift is where the insidious damage really starts. When tissues aren't getting enough oxygen, cells can't run their normal energy cycle, the Krebs cycle, efficiently. Mm. They're forced into anaerobic metabolism.
Which works, but...
But the byproduct is lactic acid, lots of it. And that lactic acid buildup leads to metabolic acidosis. This is really key for end organ damage. If that shock state drags on, the acidosis itself starts to poison the system.
How so?
Well, it directly depresses how well the heart muscle can contract. It messes up all sorts of crucial enzyme functions throughout the body. And critically important in trauma, it seriously impairs the blood's ability to clot. The clotting factors don't work well in an acidic environment.
So fixing the acidosis, which we track with serial lactates or base deficit, is just as vital as actually stopping the bleeding itself.
Absolutely crucial. They go hand in hand for a successful resuscitation. All right, moving into actually recognizing shock quickly. This is where sharp nursing assessment is absolutely paramount. We need to spot it before those classic vital signs completely fall apart.
Okay, give us the mantra. The one thing the sources say we absolutely have to burn into our brains for trauma assessment.
It's simple, direct, and tells you what to do. Any injured patient who is cool to the touch A&D tachycardic should be considered in shock until proven otherwise.
Cool and tachycardic. Got it. It combines those two key signs of early compensation we just talked about.
Exactly. Sympathetic shunting, causing cool skin, and the compensatory heart rate increase. See both. Assume shock.
Now, let's tackle the biggest assessment trap, the one that leads to dangerous delays because people wait too long, relying only on systolic blood pressure.
Well, this is so critical, especially for exams in real practice. Those compensatory mechanisms, that catecholamine surge, they're so powerful, they can keep the systolic BP looking okay, maybe even normal, until a massive amount of blood volume is already gone.
How much are we talking?
Sometimes up to 30% of total blood volume loss. 30%. If you wait for the textbook definition of hypotension, like a systolic less than 90, you've waited way too long. You've missed that golden window for intervention.
Okay, so if systolic BP is a liar early on, what's the priority vital sign cue we need to be watching like a hawk?
The narrowed pulse pressure. It's a much, much more sensitive early indicator.
Pulse pressure, just systolic minus diastolic. Why does it narrow?
Okay, think back to those catecholamines causing vasoconstriction. That tightening of the peripheral arteries primarily pushes the diastolic pressure up. So if the systolic pressure is managing to hold steady because of compensation, but the diastolic pressure is creeping up due to that squeeze.
The difference between them gets smaller.
Exactly. The pulse pressure narrows. A pulse pressure dropping below, say, 25 mmHg, even if the systolic is still over 100, is a huge red flag. It strongly suggests significant blood loss and that the body is compensating like crazy but nearing exhaustion.
That difference systolic holding while diastolic rises, that's fundamental to understanding hemorrhagic compensation. Okay, let's structure this using the classes of hemorrhage. This framework is essential for knowing how aggressively to act, right?
Absolutely. We classify hemorrhage based on the estimated percentage of blood volume lost. Remember, average adult blood volume is roughly 70 millimoles per kilogram. This classification directly guides our initial fluid choices and, crucially, when to pull the trigger on blood products.
Let's walk through them. Start with class I hemorrhage. Minimal stuff.
Right. Class I is less than 15% blood volume loss, maybe up to 750 millimoles in an average adult. Clinically, these patients look pretty okay, almost asymptomatic.
So vitals?
Minimal, if any. Tachycardia. Maybe a slight bump in heart rate, or maybe none at all. Absolutely no change in blood pressure, pulse pressure, or respiratory rate.
Mm.
The nights to know here is that a healthy person usually replaces this volume within 24 hours just through their own body mechanisms and maybe drinking fluids. Nursing, watchful waiting, IV access just in case.
Okay, moving up. Class 2 hemorrhage, now we're losing 15% to 30%. So 750 millilitres up to maybe 1500 millilitres. This is where we really start seeing those signs we talked about.
Yes, no, conversation is obvious. You'll definitely see tachycardia, usually over 100 beats per minute. You'll see tachypnea, they're breathing faster. And crucially, this is often where you first see that decreased pulse pressure because the diastolic is rising.
What about their mental state?
It changes, but subtly. They might be anxious, maybe a bit restless or fearful, but they're still generally oriented. And a key nursing assessment, urinary output, it starts to drop, reflecting reduced kidney perfusion, maybe down to 20, 30 millivolts per hour.
And the intervention for class two.
This is typically where crystalloid fluid resuscitation is the first move. Bolus them with fluids. Most will stabilize with just crystalloids at this stage.
Okay, then things get serious. Class 3 hemorrhage, now we're talking 31% to 40% loss. That's 1,500 millimol to 2,000 millimol, a significant amount.
A very significant amount. And this level of loss is almost guaranteed to overwhelm the compensatory mechanisms. You will now see a measurable fall in systolic blood pressure.
So hypotension finally shows up.
Yes, along with marked tachycardia, maybe over 120. Significant tachypnea. And now, major mental status changes, confusion, agitation, progressing to lethargy. They're not perfusing their brain well. Urinary output is way down, maybe only 5 to 15 millimoles per hour or less.
Management for class 3. Big shift here.
Huge shift. This needs immediate aggressive action. Rapid crystalloid infusion, yes, but you're almost certainly going to need blood products, packed red blood cells, PRBCs, at a minimum. And critically, you need immediate hemorrhage control. This patient likely needs to go to the OR or interventional radiology now.
And finally, the worst case. Class 4 hemorrhage. Lost greater than 40%, over 2 liters.
This is an immediately life-threatening, often preterminal event. Compensation has utterly failed. The systolic BP is severely low. The pulse pressure might be barely measurable or even zero.
At rate. Still tachycardic.
Markedly tachycardic initially, but then, ominously, they can become bradycardic just before cardiac arrest as the heart muscle itself becomes profoundly ischemic and acidotic.
Yeah.
Urinary output. Negligible. Skin is cold, pale, mottled. Mental status is severely depressed, maybe unresponsive.
Management is basically everything, all at once.
Pretty much. Concurrent actions. Activate the massive transfusion protocol immediately. Get blood in as fast as possible. And you need immediate, definitive surgical or angiographic control of the bleeding source. You are literally racing against the clock. Minutes matter here.
That classification is incredibly helpful for framing the response. But trauma isn't always just straightforward volume loss. We have to be sharp enough to differentiate true hemorrhagic shock from other things that can mimic it, especially problems above the diaphragm causing obstructive shock.
Absolutely critical point. While the default assumption in trauma is hypovolemia until proven otherwise, if a patient isn't responding to fluids like you'd expect, you must rapidly consider and rule out these non-hemorrhagic, often mechanical causes.
Let's start with the big one, tension pneumothorax.
Yeah, this is a can't-miss, time-critical surgical emergency. It causes obstructive shock. What happens is air gets into the pleural space, usually from a lung injury, during inspiration, but it can't get out during expiration, like a one-way valve.
Pressure builds up.
Massively. And that pressure pushes the entire mediastinum, the heart, the great vessels, the trachea over to the opposite uninjured side.
Yeah.
This shift kinks the vena cava, blocking venous return to the heart. Preload drops to near zero.
Key signs. How do we spot it fast?
Acute severe respiratory distress is number one. On exam, you'll find absent breath sounds on the affected side. If you percuss that side, it'll be hyper-resonant, like tapping on a drum, because of the trapped air. And a late, really ominous sign is tracheal deviation. You can actually see or feel the trachea pushed away from the injured side.
Management.
Immediate decompression. Don't wait for anything. Needle decompression in the second intercostal space, midclavicular line, or finger thoracostomy in the fifth intercostal space, anterior axillary line. Get that air out now. You do not wait for a chest x-ray confirmation.
Okay. Compare that to cardiac tamponade, another obstructive cause.
Right. Tamponade is also obstructive, but the mechanism is different. Here, blood rapidly fills the pericardial sac, the space around the heart. That sac is pretty rigid, so as it fills, it squeezes the heart and prevents it from filling properly during diastole. Again, preload and stroke volume plummet.
Signs. Is Beck's triad reliable?
The classic Beck's triad hypotension. Muffled heart sounds and distended neck veins. Elevated GVP. It's taught everywhere, but honestly, in acute trauma, it's often incomplete or totally absent. The muffled sounds can be hard to hear in a noisy trauma bay. GVP might be down if they're also hypovolemic.
So how do we reliably differentiate it from a tension pneumo if the triad isn't there?
The key differentiator is the lungs. Tamponade does not cause absent breath sounds or hyperresonance. Breath sounds should be equal bilaterally unless there's another injury. We rely heavily on bedside ultrasound, the FAST exam, focused assessment with sonography for trauma, to quickly look for fluid around the heart.
Okay, so tension pneumo equals bad lung sounds plus maybe tracheal shift. Tamponade, clear lung sounds plus maybe JVD plus confirmed fluid on FAST.
Got it. What about the third type, neurogenic shock? Mm-hmm. This one's different, distributive, right?
Exactly. Neurogenic shock isn't about volume loss or obstruction. It's a problem with the container. It happens typically with a severe spinal cord injury high up in the cervical or upper thoracic region.
What does the injury do?
It interrupts the sympathetic nervous system pathways that normally maintain vascular tone. Without that sympathetic input, you get massive widespread vasodilation below the level of the injury. The blood vessels basically go slack, creating a much larger space for the existing blood volume.
So the volume is there, but the tank got too big.
Precisely. And the critical manifestation, the thing that makes it unique, is hypotension without the expected compensatory tachycardia. The sympathetic signal to speed up the heart is also lost. And you also don't see that cutaneous vasoconstriction.
So no cool, clammy skin. Nope. The skin below the level of injury will often be warm, flushed, and dry because the blood vessels are wide open. You also won't see that narrowed pulse pressure because peripheral resistance has plummeted, so the diastolic pressure is low, not high.
Okay, but tricky part, these patients can have other injuries, right? Bleeding elsewhere.
Huge point. Up to 50% of patients with significant spinal cord injuries have other major torso trauma. So the initial management rule is always treat for hypovolemia first. Give them fluids. If they remain hypotensive despite adequate fluid resuscitation, then you strongly suspect neurogenic shock and might need to carefully add vasopressors to restore some vascular tone. But volume first.
All right, let's shift gears into the practical, hands-on nursing priorities. What do you do first? We start with the ABCDEs, always.
Always. A. B. Airway and breathing. You need to ensure a patent airway and provide supplemental oxygen immediately. The goal is to keep that O2 saturation above 95%. You've got less blood circulating maybe, so you need to maximize the oxygen carried by every red blood cell that is circulating.
Makes sense. Then C, circulation. And the absolute first priority within circulation, our sources hammer this home, is hemorrhage control. Stop the bleeding.
Yes. Before you even worry about calculating how much they've lost, you have to stop them from losing more. That is priority number one.
What does that look like practically?
For obvious external bleeding, it's direct pressure first. If that's not enough, wound packing. For massive extremity hemorrhage, uncontrolled by pressure, it's immediate tourniquet application, high and tight. Don't hesitate if it's life-threatening bleeding.
What about internal bleeding? The stuff we can't see.
That's often the most dangerous. We have to think anatomically and stabilize potential sources quickly. Suspect an unstable pelvic fracture. Apply a pelvic binder or even just a tightly wrapped sheet at the level of the greater trochanters. Obvious femur fracture. Traction splint helps reduce bleeding and pain. Stop the leak, externally or internally, by stabilization.
Okay, so stop the bleed. At the same time, or immediately after, we need access. Big IVs, right? This is where that physics lesson comes in.
Poiseuille's law. Sounds fancy, but the takeaway is simple and critical for nurses. Flow rate through a tube is hugely dependent on its radius specifically, radius to the fourth power, and it's inversely related to length, longer tube, slower flow.
So for getting fluids in fast?
You need lines that are short and fat. That's the bottom line. A short, 18-gauge peripheral IV in the AC fossa will flow fluids way, way faster than a long, skinny 20-gauge in the hand or even a long central line like a PICC. For trauma resuscitation, the standard is 2 large-bore peripheral IVs, minimum 18-gauge, preferably 16 or even 14 if you can get them. Location matters, too. AC or external jugular, if needed, are better than distal sites.
2 short, fat pipes. Got it. Access secured, bleeding controlled or addressed. Next is D, disability.
Right, quick neuro check. Assess their level of consciousness using AVPU or GCS. This directly reflects how well their brain is being perfused. You need to repeat this assessment frequently, especially after you start giving fluids or blood to see if they're improving.
And E, exposure and environment.
Get them fully undressed to do a complete head-to-toe secondary survey looking for other injuries. But, and this is crucial, while you're exposing them, you must be aggressively preventing hypothermia.
Back to the lethal triad.
Exactly. Hypothermia kills trauma patients by worsening acidosis and screwing up coagulation. Get warm blankets on them immediately. Use fluid warmers for everything going in crystalloids, blood products. Target warming fluids to around 39 degrees Celsius, that's 102.2 Fahrenheit. External warming devices like bear huggers, if available. You cannot let them get cold.
Okay, now the actual fluid strategy. We've got access. What do we give first?
Usually you start with an initial bolus of isotonic crystalloid. Lactated Ringer's is often preferred over normal saline because large volumes of NS can cause hyperchloremic metabolic acidosis, but either works initially.
How much?
Standard adult bolus is 1 liter, given rapidly. For kids under 40 kilos, it's 20 milliliters per kilogram. The goal of this initial phase isn't necessarily to get their blood pressure back to normal 1280 right away. It's to restore perfusion to the vital organs.
Which brings us to that tricky concept, permissive hypotension. Tolerating a lower than normal BP on purpose. When and why do we do that? This confuses a lot of people.
It is definitely counterintuitive, which makes it important to understand. Permissive hypotension, or sometimes called hypotensive resuscitation, is mostly considered for patients with penetrating trauma, like gunshot wounds or stab wounds, where you suspect ongoing, uncontrolled internal bleeding.
Why hold back on fluids, then?
The thinking is, if you aggressively push fluids to raise the BP back to normal before the bleeding source is surgically controlled, you might actually do harm. You could potentially pop the clot, dislodge a fragile clot that's forming at the injury site. You'll also risk diluting the remaining clotting factors, making the coagulopathy worse.
So you aim for a lower target.
Yeah, you accept a lower systolic BP target, often around 90 millimilli HG, maybe slightly lower in some protocols, just enough to ensure perfusion to the brain and heart. It's a temporary bridge strategy until they can get to the OR for definitive hemorrhage control. It's generally not used for patients with blunt trauma, especially if they have a head injury, because the brain needs good perfusion pressure, and not usually for the elderly or those with pre-existing heart conditions.
Okay, that makes sense. A bridge, not a destination. What about when crystalloids clearly aren't enough? When do we switch to blood?
You switch early and decisively. Don't wait too long. The trigger for activating the massive transfusion protocol, or MTP, varies slightly by institution, but common triggers include needing more than 4 units of packed red blood cells within the first hour, or anticipating a need for more than 10 units in 24 hours. Or sometimes based on specific clinical criteria like penetrating torso trauma plus hypotension.
And the MTP isn't just about red cells, right? It's about balanced resuscitation.
Critically important, early uncontrolled hemorrhage causes loss of whole blood red cells, plasma with clotting factors, and platelets. So replacing just red cells isn't enough and can worsen coagulopathy. MTP aimed to deliver a balanced ratio of components, mimicking whole blood.
What's the typical ratio?
It's often 1 unit of PRBCs to 1 unit of fresh frozen plasma, FFP, to 1 unit of platelets, sometimes written as 1.1.1. Some centers use slightly different ratios, like 1.1.2. The goal is to replace clotting factors and platelets, along with the oxygen carrying capacity from the red cells right from the start to combat that lethal triad component of coagulopathy.
What about blood type in an emergency?
For patients who are actively exsanguinating, you don't have time to wait for cross-matched blood. You use type O universal donor blood immediately. Preferably O negative, especially for females of childbearing potential to avoid Rh sensitization, but O positive is used if O negative isn't available or supply is short.
Got it. Okay. Medication considerations. What's a definite no-no early on, and what's a must-do?
The big no-no as a first-line treatment in pure hemorrhagic shock is vasopressors. Drugs like norepinephrine, levo, phenylephrine, neo, vasopressin.
Why not? They raise blood pressure, right?
They do, but they work by causing intense vasoconstriction. In a patient who's already volume depleted, their body is already maximally vasoconstricted due to that sympathetic surge. Adding a vasopressor on top of that just clamps down peripheral perfusion even further, worsening tissue ischemia, driving up lactate, and potentially accelerating organ failure. It's like whipping a dying horse. You need to fill the tank first. Volume resuscitation is the priority.
Okay, so volume first, maybe pressors much later if needed after volume is restored, or in neurogenic shock, what's the must-do medication?
Tranexamic acid, or TXA. This drug helps stabilize blood clots by inhibiting fibrinolysis, the process that breaks down clots.
When do we give it?
The evidence is clear. TXA improves survival, but only if given early. It absolutely must be administered within 3 hours of the time of injury. After 3 hours, it may actually be harmful.
What's a dose?
Standard protocol is usually a 1 gram loading dose given intravenously over 10 minutes, followed by a second 1 gram infusion administered over the next 8 hours. Nurses play a critical role in ensuring this gets given within that crucial 3 hour window. Documenting the time of injury and time of administration is vital.
Okay, we're doing all this controlling bleeding, giving fluids, giving blood, giving TXA. How do we know if it's working? How do we monitor the response effectively?
Besides watching the vital signs and mental status, the single best bedside indicator of overall systemic perfusion, especially to the vital organs, is urinary output.
The kidneys don't lie.
Pretty much. If the kidney, that's a huge red flag for the nurse. It strongly suggests either ongoing, uncontrolled blood loss that hasn't been addressed, or that your resuscitation efforts are simply not keeping up. You need to reassess immediately and escalate care.
And what about labs to track the response at the cellular level?
Serial measurements of serum lactate and/or base deficit are essential. These directly reflect the degree of tissue hypoxia and anaerobic metabolism. As you successfully resuscitate the patient and restore oxygen delivery, these numbers should start trending down. Lactate should be clearing. Base deficit should be improving, getting less negative. If they're staying high or getting worse despite aggressive treatment, that tells you the shock state isn't resolving.
Okay, one last piece here is how the patient responds to that initial fluid bolus. That can tell you a lot about what's going on and what needs to happen next, right?
Absolutely. We usually categorize their response into one of three patterns. Mm. This is very high yield for understanding their trajectory.
Pattern one.
The rapid responder. These are typically patients with class 1 or maybe early class 2 hemorrhage. You give them that initial 1 liter crystalloid bolus, and their vital signs quickly normalize and stay normal. Heart rate comes down, BP comes up, pulse pressure widens.
What do you do then?
You can usually slow the IV fluids down to a maintenance rate, but you keep a very close eye on them. Keep blood products available just in case, but they've likely stabilized from the initial fluid challenge.
Okay, pattern two.
The transient responder. This is more typical of class 2 or class 3 hemorrhage. They get the initial fluid bolus, and they improve vital signs, get better temporarily. But then as the fluids slow down or stop infusing, their vital signs start to deteriorate again. BP drops, heart rate climbs back up.
What does that tell you?
It tells you they likely have significant ongoing blood loss that hasn't been adequately controlled, or the initial resuscitation volume just wasn't enough. This pattern is a strong indicator that they need blood products now, and more importantly, they need rapid surgical or angiographic intervention to find and stop the bleeding source. They are actively bleeding.
And the third, most worrying pattern?
The minimal or no response group.
Right.
These are often patients with class 4 hemorrhage, or maybe an obstructive shock we missed. You pour in fluids, you start blood, and nothing happens. Or they get maybe a flicker of improvement that vanishes immediately. Vital signs remain critical.
Management here.
This demands immediate, definitive intervention. Straight to the OR or angio suite for hemorrhage control. And if you're certain the bleeding is controlled but they're still unresponsive, you absolutely must rapidly reassess for those non-hemorrhagic causes. Did we miss a tension pneumothorax? Is there cardiac tamponade developing? Could it be profound myocardial failure, like from a cardiac contusion? You have to broaden the differential fast.
Okay, so we've covered the basics, but real-world trauma is messy. Patients rarely fit perfectly into those classes. We need to talk about the things that muddy the waters, starting with that deadly feedback loop, the lethal triad.
Yes, the lethal triad of trauma. It's the vicious, self-perpetuating cycle of coagulopathy, impaired blood clotting, hypothermia, low body temperature, and acidosis. Too much acid in the blood from that poor perfusion.
And they all make each other worse, right?
Exactly. It's a biological death spiral. Hyperthermia directly inhibits platelet function and slows down the enzymatic reactions of the clotting cascade. Acidosis also impairs clotting factor function and can worsen myocardial depression. And of course, ongoing bleeding, coagulopathy, leads to more volume loss, worsening perfusion, which causes more acidosis and makes it harder to stay warm. You got to try and break the cycle everywhere at once.
So the nursing priority we already hit on, aggressively preventing hypothermia, is partly about stopping this cycle.
Absolutely. Keeping the patient warm isn't just for comfort. It's critical for allowing their blood to clot effectively. Warm fluids, warm blankets, warm room. It's non-negotiable. Heating fluids to 39 degrees C, 102.2 degrees F, is a key intervention.
What about monitoring the coagulation part of the triad beyond basic labs?
Well, standard labs like PT, PDT, INR, and platelet count give you a baseline, but they have limitations. They take time to come back from the lab, and they don't always reflect the functional clotting ability, especially in patients on some of the newer direct oral anticoagulants, DOACs.
So what else is used?
Many trauma centers now use viscoelastic testing right at the bedside or in the lab with rapid turnaround. The main types are thrombolistography, TEG, or rotational thrombolistometry, ROTEM. These tests give a dynamic picture of the entire clotting process, how fast a clot forms, how strong it is, and whether it's breaking down too quickly.
And that helps guide treatment.
Precisely. Instead of just giving the standard 1.1.1 ratio of blood products, PEG or ROTEM results can help tailor therapy. They might show, for instance, that the patient needs more fibrinogen, so you'd give cryoprecipitate, or that their platelets aren't working well, so you prioritize platelets. It allows for more targeted, goal-directed resuscitation of the coagulopathy.
Okay, besides the triad, we have patients who just don't read the textbook. Their physiology is different. Let's talk about special populations where the classic signs of shock, like tachycardia, might be totally misleading. First up, the elderly.
Elderly patients are a major challenge. Their physiological reserve is often significantly diminished. Their hearts might be stiffer, less compliant, and crucially, they often have a blunted response to catecholamines. Their heart rate might not increase much or at all, even when they're severely hypovolemic.
So relying on tachycardia is dangerous.
Extremely dangerous. They may also be chronically somewhat dehydrated due to diuretics, decreased thirst sensation, or other illnesses, so they start with less volume in the tank.
So if their heart rate isn't a reliable sign, and their baseline volume might be low, how do we spot shock early in them?
You have to have a much lower threshold for suspicion and intervention. A systolic blood pressure of, say, 100 or 110 mmHg, which might seem reassuring in a younger person, could actually represent profound class 3 or 4V shock in an elderly patient whose normal baseline BP was much higher.
What should we rely on then?
Changes in mental status are often one of the earliest and most reliable signs. Any confusion, lethargy, or agitation should be taken very seriously. You need to look closely at other perfusion indicators. Skin temperature, capillary refill, though this can also be less reliable in the elderly, and definitely urinary output. Early use of advanced monitoring, like an arterial line for continuous BP monitoring or tracking lactate-based deficit trends, is often warranted because their window for successful resuscitation is much narrower. Delay is often fatal.
Yeah, what about the other end of the spectrum? Highly conditioned athletes, they look fine, maybe too fine.
Yeah, athletes, especially endurance athletes like marathon runners, can be deceptively compensated. They often have a significantly higher circulating blood volume to begin with, maybe 15-20% more than average. They also tend to have a very high resting stroke volume due to cardiac conditioning, which often results in a lower resting heart rate baseline bradycardia.
So their compensation is super powered.
Exactly. They can tolerate a larger absolute volume loss before their compensatory mechanisms are overwhelmed and their vital signs start to crash. They might look remarkably stable, maybe only mildly tachycardic, even when they've bled well into class 2 or even class 3 levels.
So their normal bradycardia and extra volume mean tachycardia is a very late sign for them. What's the nursing priority?
Never ever be falsely reassured by their initial stable vital signs if the mechanism of injury is significant. If an injured athlete shows any subtle signs, maybe just slightly cool skin, maybe they seem a little anxious or off, assume significant blood loss until proven otherwise.
What signs can you trust?
You have to rely on the objective measures that cut through their enhanced compensation. Serial lactate or base deficit trends are crucial. Carefully assess pulse pressure even if their systolic is good. Is the diastolic creeping up? Monitor urinary output closely. Those metrics are harder for even a highly conditioned body to mask completely.
Okay, another big one. Patients on common heart medications. Beta blockers are everywhere.
Huge confounder. Beta blockers and, to some extent, calcium channel blockers pharmacologically prevent the heart rate from increasing in response to stress or volume loss. They block the beta receptors that catecholamines normally stimulate.
So the classic sign of tachycardia is just gone.
It's either completely absent or significantly blunted. You could have a patient bleeding heavily, needing that compensatory tachycardia, but their heart rate is stuck at 60 or 70 because of their metoprolol. It gives a dangerous false sense of security.
So if you know your patient is on a beta blocker and they're injured, what do you focus on instead of the heart rate?
You have to rely on everything else. Mental status changes, disability, skin assessment temperature, color, capillary refill, exposure, urinary output trends. And again, watch that pulse pressure very closely. Is it narrowing? The vasoconstriction part of the sympathetic response isn't blocked by beta blockers, so the diastolic pressure might still rise, narrowing the pulse pressure even if the heart rate stays low. You have to use all the other pieces of the puzzle. What about patients on diuretics? They might already be volume down. Good point. Diuretics can cause baseline hypovolemia and electrolyte issues like hypokalemia, further complicating things.
What about pregnant patients?
Pregnancy presents unique challenges. They have a normal physiological hypervolemia. Their blood volume increases significantly by like 30-50% during pregnancy. This means they can lose a much larger absolute volume of blood before showing the typical signs of shock, like hypotension or tachycardia.
So by the time a pregnant patient looks shocked, she's lost a massive amount of blood.
A massive amount. And fetal distress may occur long before maternal vital signs become abnormal.
Mm.
So you need a very high index of suspicion, liberal use of fluids, early involvement of OB, and continuous fetal monitoring if the fetus is viable. Assume significant injury until proven otherwise.
And lastly, patients whose heart rate is literally fixed. Pacemakers or ICDs.
Right. If a patient has a pacemaker set at a fixed rate, say 70 beats per minute, their heart cannot respond to blood loss by increasing the rate. Tachycardia is physiologically impossible. Their cardiac output becomes entirely dependent on stroke volume.
So how do you assess them?
You ignore the heart rate number as an indicator of compensation. Your entire focus shifts to maximizing stroke volume, which means aggressive volume replacement preload is paramount. You assess their perfusion status using all the other signs. Mental status, skin perfusion, capillary refill, urinary output, pulse pressure, lactate levels. The heart rate monitor is effectively useless for judging their response to volume loss in this specific context. Okay, let's boil this all down. Core imperatives, the absolute high-yield testable nuggets you need to take away from this deep dive.
Priority one, always stop the bleeding first. Everything else, fluids, blood, it's all secondary to getting hemorrhage control.
And remember the drug paradox, vasopressors. Contraindicated as a first line in hemorrhagic shock. Fill the tank first. Don't just squeeze empty pipes harder.
For spotting shock early, don't wait for the systolic BP to drop, that narrowed pulse pressure, the diastolic rising. That's your much more sensitive early warning sign.
If you give fluids and blood and the patient only improves for a little while, then crashes again, transient response, or doesn't improve at all. The number one reason is usually ongoing undiagnosed bleeding. That patient needs surgery or angio, stat.
Your key nursing metric for perfusion, urinary output, goal for adults, greater than 0.5 milliliter per kilogram per hour. If it's low, perfusion is inadequate.
Know your shock pattern.
Yes.
Durogenic shock, equal tempo tension, without tachycardia, without cool, clammy skin. Warm, dry, hypotensive, bradycardic, different beast.
And that immediate lifesaver. If you suspect tension pneumothorax, respiratory distress, absent breath sounds, maybe tracheal shift, don't wait for an x-ray, immediate needle or finger decompression. It's a mechanical fix for a mechanical problem. #, #, #, outro. So wrapping this up, this deep dive really shows that managing trauma shock isn't just about following steps A, B, C. It's about synthesis. It's recognizing those early, often subtle signs of compensation, cool skin, tachycardia, that narrowing pulse pressure, then acting simultaneously. Stop the leak, push warm fluids and blood products early, and aggressively fight that lethal triad. It's high-speed critical thinking in action.
Exactly. And to leave you with something to really chew on, something that integrates these tricky confounding factors we discussed. Imagine you have a 75-year-old patient, history of hypertension, takes metoprolol. Mm. They come in after a fall, suspected pelvic fracture. Their BP is 105 over 70, heart rate is 60. It's kind of stable.
Okay, but they're elderly. On a beta blocker.
Precisely.
Yeah.
So how do you rapidly, confidently differentiate between maybe just a stable class I bleed versus deep, masked, potentially lethal class 3 shock?
Hmm.
Given those confounders, what is your absolute priority assessment tool? the thing you look at first to get the real picture, since the heart rate is useless and the BP might be lying.
Right. You can't trust the heart rate because of the beta blocker. The BP of 10570 might be terrible for this patient's baseline, so you have to look past those. Calculate the pulse pressure. 105 minus 70 is 35 mmHg, getting a bit narrow. Check their skin temp aggressively. Check mental status. And crucially, get that initial lactate or base deficit level stat. That metabolic snapshot, the evidence of cellular stress, might be your only early clue to the catastrophe hiding behind seemingly okay number.
That's the level of thinking required. Look beyond the obvious. We wish you the very best in your studies and your practice.
We'll catch you on the next Deep Dive.